You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. As I've mentioned throughout the week, tomorrow I will be in Seattle tomorrow night at the Seattle Town Hall, giving a talk as part of the Town Hall Civics series about my book, The Crash of 2016, and our current contemporary economic and political events. And on Friday, I'll be at the First Unitarian Church in Portland, and therefore I won't be here to do brunch with Bernie. So Senator Sanders was kind enough to show up today and join us. Oh, one other quick announcement. Just welcome to our newest TV affiliate stations. Just went on this week. Friday Harbor Cable in San Juan County, Washington, Moorhead Community Access in Moorhead, Minnesota, and surrounding areas, Ramsey, Washington Cable Commission in White Bear, Lake, Minnesota, and surrounding areas. So, but Senator Sanders is with us. We're going to do brunch with Bernie on, is it Wednesday? It's Wednesday. Yes, on Wednesday. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And just, you know, to all of our listeners and viewers, we'll ask Bernie how everything's going on in the world, and then we'll be taking your calls.
Everybody, people should not get confused. You have to go to work tomorrow. Today is Wednesday. It's not Friday.
That's right.
And last Friday, I couldn't be on the show because I was in South Carolina, and then we went to North Carolina, and then we went to Minnesota, and I had a great trip. And on that trip, Tom, it just reinforced to me that this business of red state, blue state is not really the reality in America today. You got good people. You have progressive people. You have working class people who understand that government can and must start working for ordinary people rather than the millionaire and billionaire class. And we had an opportunity to meet with many of them in South Carolina and North Carolina. So it was a good trip.
That's great. That's great.
As many listeners may know, just an hour or so ago, we had a vote here on raising the minimum wage at a time when we have more people living in poverty than at any time in American history, over 46 million, at a time when the minimum wage has not kept pace with inflation and is today a starvation wage of $7.25 an hour, what we proposed, and I think it was a modest proposal, was raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. And sadly enough, we could not get one Republican to support that modest piece of legislation. And we got, I think we ended up with 54 votes, but in the Senate, when the Republicans filibuster, we need 60 votes, and we didn't reach that. But we're not going to give up on this, Tom. I think if we raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, over 20 million people would be taken out of poverty. And while $10.10 is certainly nothing to write home about, it's a lot better than $7.25 an hour. So we're going to keep that fight. In a time when so many of the new jobs that are being created are part-time and low-wage jobs, we have to raise the minimum wage. I think $10.10 is a modest start. I would like to go further than that. But what we have to do as a nation now is put pressure on Republicans and say, sorry, what the world is about is not just tax breaks for billionaires and millionaires and large corporations. What the real world is about is that we have millions of families who are struggling to put bread on the table, to put gas in the car, and they need some help. And yes, they may not make huge campaign contributions. They're not the Koch brothers. They're not going to contribute tens of thousands of dollars into some political party or a campaign. They are human beings, and many of them are hurting, and we've got to raise the minimum wage. So that fight continues, and the effort now is to start winning some Republican support for it. Yeah. In terms of health care, we're making some success after the disastrous rollout of the Affordable Care website. It turns out that over 8 million people have gotten on to the exchange, more than had been anticipated. Millions more are going to get health insurance because their kids are going to take advantage of their parents' program, and millions more are going to be able to see an expansion of Medicaid. And while a lot of attention has been focused on the very poor rollout of the Affordable Care Act, which is certainly worth commenting on, what has not been discussed enough is the fact that we have over 20 Republican states in this country who, when the federal government expanded Medicaid, 100% costs will be picked up by the federal government. These states said, yes, you know, we have hundreds of thousands of working class people who can't afford health insurance. Yes, thank you, the federal government providing 100% of the costs for the next 3 years and 90% after that. But no, we're not going to take advantage of that because of ideological and political reasons. We believe in private health insurance. We do not believe in the Affordable Care Act, and therefore we're going to deny health care to millions and millions of people. And there are studies out there that will tell you that people are going to die, obviously, because they don't have access to health care. People who are going to end up a lot sicker than they otherwise should be because they're not able to get into a doctor with the Medicaid. And I think that is just reprehensible. And I think we need to put pressure on every one of those governors, every one of those legislatures, and say, you know what? You just can't turn your back on working people because they don't make large campaign contributions. They're not the powerful movers and shakers in your state. So we've got to work on that issue. I just held a hearing this morning as chairman of the Veterans Committee, and it was a very interesting hearing. And the VA is actually doing a very good job, better than I think most other healthcare systems, in trying to move toward a complementary and alternative healthcare. By that I mean acupuncture, massage therapy, yoga, meditation, and therapies that can help people without over-medicating them. One of the very serious health problems we have in this country is we have a lot of over-medication. People are becoming addicted to opiates, and sometimes that translates into getting involved in heroin and getting addicted to that and all kinds of bad stuff. So what you're seeing, interestingly enough, in the VA and in the Department of Defense is if you walk into those hospitals, what you're going to find out that their patients are being given the opportunity to get involved in complementary and alternative medicine. And I applaud both the VA and the DOD for that. I think I've held town meetings on that issue in Vermont over the years. We've had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people showing up because I think people understand that there's obviously, a very important role for pharmaceuticals to play in our treatment. They save lives every single day. But that healthcare is more than just taking medication, that there are approaches toward wellness, there are approaches toward disease prevention, and there are ways to try to unite mind and body to make us healthier and stronger. And I applaud the VA and the DOD for doing that. I wanted to mention something also, Tom, if I might. There was a piece in the Washington Post the other day pointing out that my website, sanders.senate.gov, our Facebook page, has more people who are quote-unquote talking about us than anybody else in the United States Congress. We have over 280,000 people who are actively involved in discussing the important issues facing our country. And I want to thank all of those people and urge other people to get involved in that discussion. I think you and I know, Tom, that the corporate media very often does not provide the issues, provide the information that we need on the most important issues facing this country. We try to do that on our website, and we try to promote really good discussion amongst all of our people. So people who are interested in participating in the Facebook discussion, go to our website, sanders.senate.gov, and you can join many hundreds of thousands of other people who are involved in discussion. Last point that I would make is I think there is more and more understanding of the disastrous role that Citizens United has played in allowing billionaires to control our political process. You're going to see a lot of activity in trying to overturn that disastrous Supreme Court decision through a constitutional amendment.
That's marvelous. It's absolutely marvelous. Senator Sanders is with us. It's Wednesday, but we're doing a live brunch with Bernie because I'm going to be on the road the next couple of days. So, and thank you, Senator, for that. And so we'll be back with your questions for Bernie right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. And welcome back. Dave, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, you are on, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Tom and Bernie. My question is, Tom mentioned last week that a tariff of 30% on imports would be great. And he also mentioned a couple weeks earlier that a value-added tax where each import is taxed at each stage would be good. So my question is, what's the difference between a value-added tax and a tariff? And I'll take my answer offline.
Okay, Dave, I'll let Tom give you the details on it, but let me just say this. When we talk about the collapse of the American middle class, what we are talking about, among many other things, is the fact that in the last 13 or 14 years, we have lost some 50,000 manufacturing plants in America, 50,000 and millions of decent-paying jobs. Not all of those jobs have been lost because of trade agreements. Some of them, you know, folded for a number of other reasons. But a lot of them were lost because of these disastrous trade agreements like NAFTA, CAFTA, Permanent Normal Trade Relations with China, that were pushed upon the Congress by the multinational corporations and the National Association of Manufacturers and the Chamber of Commerce and all of the big money interests. And what people like Jack Welch, the former chairman of General Electric, what he said at the time, he said, look, I would want my manufacturing plant to be on a barge. Ideally, it would be on a barge so that I could take it to the lowest wage countries in the world. And that's certainly the direction that American manufacturing has gone. And it is not just blue-collar jobs that have gone to China or Mexico or elsewhere. It is white-collar jobs that are going to India and Russia and elsewhere as well, where people work for lower wages than we do in the United States of America. So what you have seen is, A, the loss of millions of good-paying jobs, and B, a race to the bottom, a downward pressure on wages, so that instead of seeing an increase in wages because of increased productivity, you're seeing a decrease in wages because American workers are now forced to compete against desperate people all over the world. Bottom line there is, A, we need to change our trade policies, and B, we have got to tell the General Electrics of the world, and by the way, GE, as I understand it, has not paid federal income tax in this country in the last 5 years because of all the tax loopholes that are out there. But it's not just GE. It's all of these major corporations. They have got to reinvest in America. They want us to buy their products. They're advertising every day on TV, buy this, buy that. Well, if they want us to buy their products, they've got to stop manufacturing their products in this country.
Yeah. Just 15 seconds, Senator. You think that SHAFTA, the Southern Hemisphere Asian, you know, the TPP, chances?
Well, as of now, Senator Harry Reid did the right thing. And he said, no, I'm not going to bring that bill before the Senate. We're certainly not going to fast track it. So as of this moment, that bill is going nowhere in a hurry, and I think that's appropriate. I think it's a bad piece of legislation for a number of reasons.
Good. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders in our Brunch with Bernie National Town Hall meeting on Wednesday, 2 days early. Yes, we are live right now talking with Senator Sanders, so feel free to call in if you have a question for the senator. We'll be back with more of your calls with Senator Sanders right after this. Welcome back to Tom Hartman's program, Fair and Only Slightly Unbalanced. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. We're doing Brunch with Bernie 2 days early. It's Wednesday. We're live on the air on Wednesday because tomorrow I'm going to be in Seattle. The day after, I'll be in Portland. And Bernie was kind enough to come in today to do our national town hall meeting, taking your calls. Tony in Piercy, California, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for everything you do. I wanted to ask Senator Sanders, I would like to know if you know whether or not the state or the government will still attach liens to your possessions after the age of 55 with the Affordable Care Act, like they did before the Affordable Care Act was enacted.
Liens on your property.
Yeah, if there's a thing in Medicaid where if you're over 55 and you go into certain, and you have certain kinds of medical care, like when my mother went into, or almost went into long-term nursing care, you have to qualify for Medicaid, you have to exhaust your resources,
right.
And then the government
can
recover some of that from your estate.
Well, the answer is that the long-term solution of health care in America, Tony, is for the United States to do what the rest of the industrialized world does, and that is provide a national health care program guaranteeing health care to all people, regardless of income. We don't have that right now. You have a Medicare program for the elderly. You have a Medicaid program for low-income people. In order to qualify for Medicaid, you've got to be low-income. Among other things, you can't have very much money in the bank or very much in the way of assets. So I'm not quite sure of the detail that Tom raised, but to qualify, you have got to have no limited assets. And what I guess Tom is saying here is that if you undergo expensive procedures, then after your death, those assets are sold and repaid to the government?
Yeah, I don't quite understand the whole thing, Senator.
I don't either, yeah. To be honest with you, so, but that's kind of what the situation is.
Yeah, and it's a remnant, really, a pre-Obamacare remnant from the way Medicaid was structured.
But let me just repeat this point.
Sure.
And one of the debates, you know, I voted for the Affordable Care Act. I think it is making some modest improvements. It is providing health insurance through the exchanges to some 8 million people and helping other people. But at the end of the day, the debate that we as a nation have got to have, should health care be a right of all people, regardless of income, or shouldn't it be? And if it is, the logical conclusion is you move to a Medicare for all single-payer system, and I've introduced legislation to do just that. And then you don't have situations like what Tony just talked about, because health care then becomes a right. It is government-funded through a progressive tax source. Everybody gets it.
Ashes in Chicago, listening to WCPT. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Senator Sanders, for taking my call. My question is, under a single-payer system, so the patients or people have to search for a doctor that's like in-network, so do they have to ask the doctor, do they take this insurance? Under a single-payer system, isn't it true that we don't have to look for a doctor that's in the network?
That is correct. I mean, you know, in the legislation that I have written and what exists in Canada, you go to the doctor that you want to go to, period. That's about it.
John in San Francisco, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders and Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Since the Republican Party seems to think there's a problem with gerrymandering and elections and fraud and everything, is there any way we could set up a national election, get the day off, have the national elections, and basically let the people decide what's going to be moving forward in measurements? Because apparently the politicians, and not you included, but have not been able to do their jobs and to get things done. So is there any way we can get a national system, since the Republicans seem to think there's a big fraud problem in elections?
Well, I think that's an interesting idea, John, but obviously the Republican Party, which is very supportive of legislation to make it easier for the wealthy to buy elections. They pushed very much for Citizens United and McCutcheon. They want to go further. Republicans now, in terms of campaign finance, want to eliminate all restrictions on campaign spending, which means that the Koch brothers could write checks, multi-million-dollar checks, to every candidate in the country directly. Right now, they have to do it independently. But furthermore, as you've indicated, what Republican states are doing in an unprecedented way, gerrymandering is not a new idea. It's going on forever. You know, parties in control try to create districts that work for them politically. But the Republicans have taken it to an entirely new level. I just learned, I should have known this, Tom, that in North Carolina, where, as I understand it, the Republicans control their governor's office and their House and their Senate, and I think they have, a significant majority of their members of Congress. In the last election, as I was told, 51% of the votes went to the Democrats and 49% to the Republicans.
Right.
But those votes are nullified because you create certain types of districts which work for the Republicans.
Yeah, same thing in Michigan.
So the Republicans have been extremely outrageous in terms of manipulating districts to benefit themselves. Do I think we should take a look at this at a national level and figure out a way that you have reasonable districts, districts that conform to geography and to logic, rather than convoluted districts which benefit a political party? I do think so. But I think what it is clear is the Republicans cannot win on their ideas. Most people in this country do not support giving tax breaks to billionaires and cutting back on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education. They don't support that. So what the Republicans have to do to win is to make sure they buy elections with the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson. Second of all, they have to do a lot of gerrymandering to make sure they get the districts they need. And third of all, they got to engage in voter suppression, making it harder for low-income people and elderly people to vote. That's how they win elections.
Tragically. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour on Wednesday of this week. And with many thanks, much appreciation to Senator Sanders for dropping in on Wednesday, since I'm going to be on the road on Thursday and Friday. We will have live programs. Sam Cedar filling in tomorrow. Leslie Marshall filling in tomorrow and Friday. But it's Brunch with Bernie right now. We'll be right back with Senator Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov, and there are links there to his Facebook page also, which is a pretty amazing place to visit. And welcome back to our program. It's Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, our national town hall meeting 2 days early on Wednesday, live with Senator Sanders. Since I'm going to be on the road on Thursday and Friday, the senator was kind enough to come in today. You're still here, Senator?
I am right here.
Okay, great. Joe in Marietta, Georgia, you are on the air with Senator Sanders. Joe? Uh-oh. We just had a...
Gentlemen.
Oh, gentlemen, good. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, excellent. Senator Sanders, let me congratulate you on a great career. I'm sure you hear that all the time, but I appreciate who you are very much. However, I don't have nearly as much confidence in the rest of the men and women that serve with you in Congress, and the majority of the rest. I think that you are an exception and not the rule. Therefore, I wanted to know what your feeling is concerning publicly funded elections in this country, as far as like the probability that that could happen in a generation or two. Do you think that it would be a solution? And then how do you feel about term limits?
Okay, Joe, thanks for your question, and thanks for your support and your comments. I think, in a broad sense, we need a political revolution in this country. What does that mean? What it means is we need to, A, raise political consciousness. In this coming election, in 2014, the estimate is that some 60% of the people will not vote, Joe. So we're a democracy. We tout ourselves as a democracy. 60% of the people, it is estimated, will not vote. 40% will vote. And in terms of influencing the 40%, you have the Koch brothers and other folks spending huge, huge amounts of money. You have other efforts to limit people participating in the political process. That's not really the kind of democracy that I think you and I and most Americans see and believe this country should be. One of the reasons that people are so profoundly disgusted with the political system, and one of the reasons in point to fact that most members of Congress do not stand up and fight for ordinary people, is the influence of money in the political process. So it is not just that the Koch brothers and others are going to pour hundreds of millions of dollars into supporting candidates who are working day and night against the working class and the middle class of this country. It's that the people on the other side have also got to worry, and they got to go out and raise all kinds of money as well. So you have a system which is dominated by big money, which forces every single member of Congress, or virtually every member, to spend half their lives, morning, noon, and night, raising money in order to compete. It is an awful system. It needs to change. And what we need are elections where candidates can talk about their ideas and their vision for the country rather than spend their lives raising money mostly from rich people and large corporations. To my mind, to answer your questions, public funding of elections is exactly the right thing to do. It's a complicated issue. It's not a magical formula. But what we are saying by public funding is that if somebody can demonstrate a certain level of support, say they can get a $5 or a $10 contribution from X number of people to show that they're not some kind of, you know, joke, you know, that they have a certain level of support for their ideas, then the public Treasury contributes the rest, and there are limits about what can be spent. People can get on television to talk about the issues rather than flooding the airway with 30-second sound bites and TV ads. So I think if we're serious about reforming our election system, it's campaign finance reform, certainly, and included in campaign finance reform must be public funding of elections.
Bob in Crystal Lake, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Mr. Sanders and Mr. Hartman, thanks for taking the call.
Sure. Thank you.
I have a question regarding minimum wage and the health care. Stand behind both 100%. If I wanted it my way, it'd be single payer and probably raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. However, with it being subsidized, the health care plans that we have now and the minimum wage that we have now, raising it to 10-10 and raising those people out of poverty, would that negate the subsidies that they would get and then hurt enrollment in the health care?
Would people whose income go up lose their ability to get the affordable into the Affordable Care Act is the question. It's a good question, and I can't give you the answer to that. What I do know is that according to the studies that I have seen, Bob, raising the minimum wage to 10-10 an hour would take about 25 million people out of poverty. I suspect that even 10-10 is such a low wage that people would still be eligible for Medicaid and still be eligible for the exchanges. So I think it probably will not have an impact.
Yeah, we had an expert on about this a while ago who said that it may move some people out of eligibility for free Medicaid and into eligibility for 100% subsidy on the exchange. So they still pay nothing.
So people would be juggled a little bit, but
that's
I think the wages, we're still talking about such low wages.
Right, because there's still, I mean, because the Obamacare covers up to 200% of poverty or something like that, whatever the numbers are. So, yeah. Let's see here. Mike in Fresno, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I'm concerned about what I see as an attack on residential solar. I'm here in California, and I can't put a system any larger than my consumption. And that means I'm only going to use maybe a third of my roof or half. And in California, you can't get paid if you overproduce. And what are your thoughts? Is there anything that can be done on the federal level?
Well, I suspect that is a state decision, Mike. But I am the sponsor, the introducer of a bill called 10 million solar rooftops, which means that I think we should significantly incentivize solar. I think what we are seeing in recent years is the price of photovoltaic panels going down, and the more we use, the more it is going to go down. And I think that it is terribly imperative that this nation lead the world in dealing with the crisis of climate change. The scientists have been very, very clear that if we don't get our act together and we don't substantially cut back on greenhouse gas emissions, what we're going to see is more temperature rising in the oceans and on the land. We're going to see more flooding. We're going to see more drought. We're going to see more extreme weather conditions. We're going to see rising sea levels. And we're going to see real devastation. We're seeing it now. It'll only get worse. So I think that the federal government, in every way that it can, in terms of subsidizing and investing in solar, in wind, in geothermal, in heat pumps, in biomass, and other technologies, we have got to lead the world. And when we do that, we're going to save money for individuals on their fuel bills. When we move aggressively to energy efficiency, you're going to see really good things happening. And we're also going to create millions of jobs. So I think creating jobs, saving people money on their fuel bills, and cutting greenhouse gas emissions is pretty much of a win-win-win. So I believe we should do everything that we can, Mike, to expand solar both on rooftops and in utility scale.
Grant in Penfield, New York. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
This is Grant Langdon. And I was wondering if you would back a constitutional amendment that would bar people from donating to any candidate that they could not vote for.
Well, Grant, that's not exactly the way I would approach campaign finance reform, and a lot of ways that you could approach it. I think, number one, we have to end the absurdity of Citizens United and McCutcheon and make it clear that corporations are not people and cannot spend as much money as they want in terms of under the guise of free speech in buying politicians. Number two, as I mentioned earlier, I believe in public funding of elections, which would address the issue that you are talking about, Grant. So I think we want to get to the root of the issue, and that is that we got to stop big money from buying elections. And number two, we've got to give people who don't have a lot of money or don't want to go to the rich for their campaign support a fair shot, and that means public funding of elections. That would be the direction that I would go.
Okay. Barry in Mount Prospect, Illinois. We just have a minute to the break. A quick question for the Senator, Barry.
Yes. My name is Barry, and I happen to fall through the cracks in a way where I have money in the bank, but very little interest that it generates, with the interest rates teetering around 0.9%. And yet, at the same time, I've applied two different times for the Affordable Care Act, and they said that I would, you know, qualify for Medicaid. I don't, because of my assets.
Right.
What can a person do when they fall between the cracks? I'm sure I'm not alone.
You are not alone. And it's not only that people like you are falling between the cracks. There are a whole lot of other people who are getting the Affordable Care Act. They are buying insurance policies, but the policies have high deductibles and high copayments, which are also hurting them and in some cases preventing them from going to the doctor when they should. The answer, Barry, is, in my view, a national health care program, a Medicare for All single-payer program.
Very straightforward. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. We'll be back with more of your questions for Bernie right after this. Be sure to check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. It's a great news site. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz for his newsletter there, and you can also hop over to his Facebook page. We'll be right back with more of Brunch with Bernie on Wednesday.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's Brunch with Bernie on Wednesday. Yeah, we're live with Senator Sanders right now. We'll be right back. Sanders.Senate.gov. And welcome back. Bill in Pensacola, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders and Tom Hartman, I love you both. Senator Sanders, what kind of discussion is happening in either house about the escalation of troops around the Ukraine crisis, or is there any, and is this going to be another slow escalation into a military conflict? Thank you.
Thanks, Bill, and that's a very, very important question. And of course, there is discussion, and there is great concern about the growing tension between Russia and the Ukraine. You know, I would say that the main concern that I have is that the United States never again do what we did in Iraq, and that is get into a war virtually unilaterally, that we do not want a war with Russia, that we have to figure out a way through economic sanctions, working with the rest of the world to put enough pressure on Russia to make sure that they are not giving one thought to invading the Ukraine, and that we do everything we can through diplomatic channels to prevent this from being another war. We've had two wars recently, and people do not fully appreciate the impact of those wars on the men and women who served and on our finances. The war in Iraq and Afghanistan, those wars will end up costing us somewhere around $4 or $5 trillion. We lost almost 7,000 men and women in those wars. And we got several hundred thousand coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder and TBI. The cost of war is enormously high, and I do not look favorably on those guys who are always talking about how strong we have to be and military. Those wars have cost us very, very dearly in human and what's happened to people and what's happened financially. So we've got to work with the rest of the community. We've got to work our way through this thing. But the last thing in the world we want is a war.
Jim in Meridian, Mississippi, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders, it's a pleasure to talk with you today. I'm retired military, and I would just like to know when the Major Nidal Hassan in Fort Hood, Texas, will be executed. He was sentenced to death 4 years after he committed that horrible act of killing 13 American soldiers and one pregnant woman, and he also received the sum of approximately $300,000 while he was waiting for trial. Can you tell me when or if he will ever be executed?
Well, Jim, I can't. I don't know the answer to that, and that's a decision that will be made by folks who are not in the United States Congress. But you're absolutely right. What this guy did was reprehensible, unimaginable that he would turn his guns on his fellow soldiers and do what he did. And he will be, well, all I can say is that my hope is that he is punished. I'm not a great fan of the death penalty, and we'll see what happens. But this guy deserves never to see the light of day, certainly as a free person.
That's certainly where he is right now, is in lockdown. We will be back with Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie Hour on Wednesday this week, right after this. It's 10 minutes. Ready America from the Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour on Wednesday. And Charles in Opa-locka, Florida, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, my pleasure to speak to both of you guys. How are you doing today?
Good. Good.
Okay, great. My question is this. Everyone in America, the populace, we don't make the same exact paycheck. Everyone has a different amount. I mean, the way the money is distributed, your paycheck, everyone is different. So why do we have this thing where money is supposed to be free speech? If money is free speech, everyone would have the same amount of say, or, I mean, I'm sorry, have the same amount of money in the bank account, right?
Well, I understand where you're coming from, Charles. I think the decision made by the Supreme Court in Citizens United, where they equate money with free speech, is a horrendous decision and is based on very, very faulty logic. Bottom line is that the vast majority of the people in this country are going to not be spending their money on television ads. What Citizens United did is opened up the opportunity for a small number of millionaires and billionaires, a few hundred, maybe 1,000, who have huge amounts of money to essentially buy elections. And under the guise of free speech, First Amendment rights, they can now influence elections in every one of our states. And I do not believe that that is what American democracy is about. And as I mentioned earlier, Charles, our Republican colleagues want to go further. And they want to move toward the elimination of all restrictions on campaign finance so that multi-billionaires like the Koch brothers could just pay for every single campaign. They could have a whole stable of candidates. They just hand out the checks, $20 million here, $30 million, directly into the campaigns. That is the direction that we are heading unless we overturn Citizens United, unless we get the Supreme Court to understand that what they are doing is undermining the very foundations of our democratic society, unless we pass campaign, unless we pass public funding of elections. We are moving, and I've said this time and time again, toward an oligarchic form of society where not only is our economy controlled by a small number of billionaires, our political life will be controlled as well. And I think that on that issue, it's not a progressive versus a conservative issue. I think that that is a concern that people all across the political spectrum have. What people understand American democracy to be is one person, one vote. Some guy's a zillionaire, somebody's poor. They both have one vote. That's called American democracy. Not giving the billionaires the ability to spend hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in buying elections. And this is an issue of enormous consequence. But bottom line is, Charles, you're absolutely right. Buying elections is not free speech, to my mind.
Marty in Encinitas, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Tom and Senator Sanders. Thank you for taking my call. There are many issues to be passionate about today. Two of them are, for me, Citizens United, and asking Senator Sanders what I can personally do, one person in Encinitas, California, to help you run for president.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Marty. We've talked about this issue of Citizens United and campaign finance reform, and I understand, I really do, that it is not that many people don't perceive this to be a sexy issue. They're concerned about health care. They're concerned about education. They're concerned about the environment and climate change. They're concerned about veterans' rights. They're concerned about whatever it may be. There are a million issues out there. But underlying each and every one of those issues is campaign finance reform. Because if we continue down the path we are now moving, there will be a handful, and I mean a handful. The Koch brothers are worth $80 billion. Sheldon Adelson is worth some $20-plus billion. And what the Supreme Court has given them is the right to buy elections, to control the United States government. They own a lot of the economy. Now they can own the government. Unless we get a handle on that, what you're going to see is support for right-wing extremists, people who, like today in the Senate, not only do not want to vote to raise the minimum wage, they want to abolish the concept of the minimum wage. People who do not want to expand Social Security or Medicare, they want to privatize it or end those programs completely. So campaign finance reform, Citizens United, is an enormous issue. I believe we will have a constitutional amendment on the floor of the Senate in the not-too-distant future. We've got to rally the American people around that amendment. Second of all, in terms of running for president, as I've indicated before, it's something that I am thinking about. And one of the factors that will influence my decision is whether or not we can have that strong, strong grassroots movement we need to knock on millions and millions of doors with a progressive agenda. I just returned from South Carolina and North Carolina, not generally regarded as some of the most progressive states in America. But you know what? The people there do not want to cut Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. They want to make sure their kids can afford to go to college. They believe that health care is a right of citizenship. I think there are a lot of people out there in every state in this country who understand that we are moving very much in the wrong direction, who understand that big money interests have an undue influence over our economy and our political life, and want to figure out how we can create an economy that works for all people rather than just the people on top. So this is something, Marty, that I'm thinking about, and if I make that decision, love to have your support and active participation.
Senator, we just have about 30 seconds left. Thoughts for the week?
Well, the thought for the week is right now we are in the midst of a pivotal moment in American history, and that decision that we have got to make is whether we stand up for working families who are hurting, for a middle class which is disappearing, for the kids in this country where we have the highest rate of childhood poverty, and whether we are capable of standing up to the billionaires who have so much economic and political influence. In this country, in my view, if we got our act together, we can expand the middle class, we can provide college availability to all of our peer families, regardless of income. There's a lot that we can do. But to do that, we're going to have to be organized politically. We're going to have to stand up and fight.
Bernie, you're the next FDR in my mind. It is such an honor to have you on this program every week. Thank you so much for showing up today.
Thank you very much.
Senator Bernie Sanders. Be sure to check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And in the spirit of the day, actually, we've got a couple of guests coming up. The Honorable Tang Deng Anai and the State Minister of Health, Dr. Mayan Mashut Achek, are going to be with us in our third hour around 5:30 for just about 5 minutes. They are the two ministers from South Sudan. Ellen brought them over here, Ellen Ratner. Apparently all hell is breaking loose in South Sudan right now, so we wanted to get them on. They're going to be in studio. And Stephen Cohen, Professor Stephen Cohen, is going to be with us in our third hour. We're going to start out the hour with him and about his newest piece in The Nation. And the headline on that is Cold War Against Russia Without Debate. And this pretty serious stuff. So that's coming up. This hour, unless my one sheet is wrong, we're open this hour, right? Oh, R.J. Eskow. Oh, that's right, 4:20. Richard Eskow. R.J. Eskow is going to drop by, senior fellow of the Campaign for America's Future. But other than that, whenever Bernie comes on, the board lights up, and we have callers from Texas to California to Missouri to New Hampshire to Georgia to Wisconsin to Washington State right now. And others, and so I'm just going to pick up some. We'll just do a little version of Anything Goes Friday because it's Anything Goes Wednesday for me, we will have live shows tomorrow and Friday, but Leslie Marshall will be filling in for me. Rick in Austin, Texas. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind?
Yes, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. My questions concern the Keystone XL.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, Keystone XL will cross, I believe, 7 navigable rivers, and those rivers provide drinking water and farm water, or water for farming, to the residents. I would think that that would be a security risk, a national security risk.
Not to mention where it crosses the Ogallala Aquifer in places where the aquifer is close enough to the surface that a spill could contaminate the aquifer itself. Yeah.
Yes. I guess my question is, who is going to provide security for the Keystone XL?
You and me.
Me. And by that, I mean that, anybody or any terrorist group overseas can look at that and go, well, we can easily mess with their potable water and their water for farming, which would, cause a tremendous problem here for us.
Yep.
So my question is, who is going to provide security for that? Is it the federal government or is it the oil company? And my second question, the addendum to that is, who is going to pay for it?
Right. Well, if you look at how specifically with regard to the Keystone Pipeline, I don't know the answer to the question. But if you look at other oil pipelines around the country, what you find is that there basically is no security provided in advance of things like the spill in the Kalamazoo River from a couple of years ago that they're still trying to clean up because it was tar sands oil. And so it sinks in instead of floating on the top and they just can't get that stuff out. They didn't even know what was going on for a couple of days. And so there was no security provided in advance. And B, the cleanup falls largely, 100% initially to us, to you and me, just like the cleanup of the Gulf of Mexico, just like the cleanup after the Exxon Valdez. Then if we, the people, decide, we can sue and try to get, Exxon, BP, in this case it would be TransCanada, to pay back some of our costs. But if you look at the history of these kind of things, we never successfully get back all the costs. I think it's a situation very analogous to the question of who is providing security for the hundreds of millions of gallons of oil that we import from Saudi Arabia and other Middle Eastern sources every day. And the U.S. Navy is providing that security, at least as it crosses the ocean, and which means you and I are paying for it. This is a classic example. The oil industry is one of the very best examples there ever was of what in business is referred to as internalizing profit and externalizing costs, or internalizing profit and socializing costs, or privatizing profits and socializing costs. When it comes to the profit side, they're all about the private economy and free enterprise and capitalism. But when it comes to the costs, they're all about socialism. They want the government to pick that up. So, Rick, you raise a really good point. I don't know the exact details on Keystone, but I'm pretty sure that we're going to end up picking up the tab for most of it. Paul in Marietta, California. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. This is such a pleasure to say hello today and speak with you. Say, I've been involved with the PTSD therapies and so forth for some long time. And in conversations with the National Academy of Science that is speaking specifically with the Institute of Medicine, has said, and this is open for verification, Dr. Roberta Wedge has said there's no medicine known to cure PTSD. Now, with that statement, then, we go back and take a look at the 60 Minutes report from Dr. Irving Kirsch at Deaconess Hospital saying that antidepressants are only 2% effective based on placebo, and that was a Leslie Stahl report about a year and a half ago. And then there's a parallel report within Walter Reed that's, I don't think it's public, but that report also says that antidepressants are only 2% effective. And those two reports by Irving Kirsch and Walter Reed say that the effectiveness of antidepressants are based on a placebo effect and has nothing to do with the chemical ingredients.
Right.
So when we take a look at what Bernie Sanders was saying about alternative medicine, it occurs to me that antidepressants are an alternative medicine or should be cited as such.
Yeah. Well, you know, the good news, first of all, I don't disagree with your information and statistics, although I think that if you were to ask people who prescribe particularly SSRIs but other antidepressants as well for PTSD, what they would say is that they're not treating the PTSD, they're treating the secondary effects of it. They're treating the anxiety associated with it, for example. So, you know, there is a palliative argument to be made medically for the use of these drugs. I think that the addictive potential, and addiction is not even a strong enough word. People trying to get off SSRI drugs go through, you know, experiencing the feeling of electric shocks in their brains. They go through, you know, wild black depressions. I mean, just very, just you know, horrific things that I've known heroin addicts and been around them when they were detoxing, and it's just like they have a bad case of the flu for 3 or 4 days. It's nothing like, and I've known people who've tried to get off of Prozac and Effexor and some of these drugs and, you know, tried over and over and over over months and years and had no success. I am very concerned about these things. And there are alternative therapies for PTSD that actually do at least claim to be able to cure it. For example, Francine Shapiro's EMDR. This is being used by the military. In fact, the military did the initial really large, you know, 10,000-plus person studies that demonstrated the efficacy of bilateral therapies. I wrote a book about this. It's called Walking Your Blues Away. And so, you know, it's a good thing, as Bernie pointed out, that the military is embracing, that the VA is embracing these, quote, alternative therapies because they're alternatives to pharmaceuticals, basically. On the other hand, there's way too many pharmaceuticals being passed out. I think it's because you know, Bush and his wars put so much stress on the VA that, you know, it's a system that just wasn't designed for that many people that fast in that bad a shape. Paul, thanks for the call. You raise a lot of really interesting questions.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour, and, you know, sort of an anything goes Wednesday, although we are going to drop in with R.J. Richard Eskow in just a few minutes. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Victor in Pittsburgh, Missouri. Hey, Victor, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Yeah. What's up?
Hi, Tom. It's great to hear from you today. And I'm jealous you're going to Portland.
Oh, thank you.
I miss Oregon.
It's a beautiful city. It's a beautiful state, yeah. So what's on your mind?
Yeah. Anyway, I'm getting post-traumatic stress from this Berlin, I mean, over in Ukraine, because I was over in season Berlin.
Hmm.
And I've seen, you know, by, you know, the wall, you know.
Yeah, I was there too.
And
I was there in 86, 87.
I was there in 83.
Yeah.
And the thing is that what really disturbs me is that they really don't understand that how much the Russians lost, how many people died, about a third.
Yeah, it was like 30 or 40 million people, wasn't it? I mean, it was some mind-boggling number, maybe 20 million. I mean, it was just huge.
They have a memorial in East Berlin that I went to. I think it was like 20 some odd million. I think it was just on the front, I think.
Right.
Alone.
Yeah. Just Russian, you know, Russian soldiers in the war. Yeah. Not to mention, you know, when the Nazis invaded Russia, you know, the right. Robbing, raping, and pillaging of the cities.
And then also the whole thing about Nazism and the large Jewish population and just the whole nine yards. It's just a
mm-hmm.
It's kind of like I'm reliving it.
Yeah.
Because that was part of the thing. And then also your last guest was talking about post-traumatic stress, and I had delayed post-traumatic stress. It took about 30 years. I had this blank thing that happened to me over when I was in Berlin. I was raped. And what you were talking about, the SRIs,
mm-hmm.
That in itself, I was on Zoloft for a long time.
Yeah.
And it took away all my emotions. And I said, you know what? I am not going to walk around and not have any kind of, I mean, somebody could die right in front of me. I would have no emotion at all. And I'm a very emotional person,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm sensitive. And as far as loving and caring, I'm not suicidal. I'm not homicidal. You know, I'm a very caring, loving person. But what bothers me is that the drug itself, those drugs are very, very dangerous. And I got off them. It took me about 3 years.
Yeah.
And I took myself off them.
Yeah. Good on you. I mean, I know that there are some people who need these drugs to function, and I wouldn't begrudge them at all. There are some people who need narcotics to function. God bless them. You know, let them have them. But I think that they're A, overprescribed, and B, the evidence that so many of these people who have done mass shootings have been on these drugs, and the drugs have dulled their emotions to the point that they don't feel empathy. They don't experience the other people as human beings, and therefore they can kill them. That's a damn scary thing for me. And in fact, that's one of the reasons, thank you, Victor, for the call, why the FDA has black labeled these drugs as suicide. You know, suicide by cop, suicide, you know, going out to Flint, blaze of glory. It's all the same stuff. We'll be right back. And find Richard Eskow on the line with us, senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, and host of the brand new radio show rolling out this weekend, if my inside sources are right. This is thezerohour.com is the website, The Zero Hour, the program. Richard, welcome back to the program.
Tom, thanks so much for having me back.
And I understand that on TV you're going to be calling yourself RJ. Is that...
Well, you know, for the program, it's shorter than Richard. It fits underneath the logo better, but, you know, I go by either. I'll answer to either.
Okay. So tell us about the show.
Well, basically, it's a one-week, three-hour program where we look at all the stuff that, I couldn't call it the big picture, for example, because that name was taken, but, you know, we look at all the large forces that are affecting the stories in the news that week, whether it's economic forces, wealth inequality, whether it's scientific or technological innovations, whether it's climate change and climate-related issues. So we really kind of take the broader trends and what's happening in the news. It might be also fashion, culture, music, whatever, but we try to put it in a larger context while we talk about it. We have a number of guests every week, everything from religious people to atheists to economists to scientists to engineers who are coming up with new products. So we try to keep it fun and fast-moving and talk about what's going on.
Why this is Zero Hour?
Well, the show is called The Zero. I'll actually tell you how the name came about. I was emailing with the team trying to come up with a name, couldn't do it, and finally I said to everybody, come on, guys, this is The Zero Hour. We need a name by close of business today. And then I thought, this is The Zero Hour, meaning this is the moment at which we must make certain decisions and take some actions, or else the future will be irreversibly shaped for the worse. If we take action now, it'll be shaped for the better. If we fail to, things will be shaped for the worse. In climate change, in the oligarchical wealth, increasing wealth inequality, I'm not saying all is lost if we don't act now, but it's a very important time. It's a time to take action, and so I thought that would make a good name for the show.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, all could be lost if we don't act now. It is a zero hour. I'm curious. I've been, and in fact, you're going to be on our TV show tonight talking about this, and also about Thomas Piketty's new book, Capital,
right,
and how it's such a hit. What, and you know, my book, The Crash of 2016, which covers a lot of these areas, and there's a raft of these books out right now that are talking about how economics, politics, and the billionaire culture have. And 33 years of Reaganomics have all converged to create a crisis in both capitalism and democracy, and, you know, with varied suggestions about how to get out of them. But basically, this consensus that we can't make it here anymore, as Barry McMurtry, was it, says?
It was his son, James.
James McMurtry, yeah, you're right, thank you. So, your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think that what we're seeing now is that the crisis of democracy, as represented in Citizens United, the McCutcheon decision, money and politics, and the crisis of an unequal economy, an economy so plagued with inequality, the enormously wealthy few and the struggling many, that it's going to have trouble surviving. They're one problem. They're two sides of the same coin, which is when power and wealth is, and the founding fathers knew this, as you know well, when power and wealth are overaccumulated, democracy and the well-being of the overall population is threatened. And I think what we're seeing now, because we have a global economy as opposed to simply a national economy, is that problem is multiplied even more from what the founding fathers saw, and we really are at a point where it feels like a black hole, you know, where it reaches a size that its expansion and its eventual collapse becomes irreversible. We're teetering at the edge of an enormous accumulation. We already have an enormous accumulation of wealth and power, and if it goes much further, democracy and the kind of economy we were used to in the 50s, 60s, and 70s will collapse in upon themselves, and certainly the 50s and 60s will collapse, and it will be very, very tough to get them back.
Yeah. In his new book, John Paul Stevens says, in Buckley, the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia had upheld the statutory limitations on both contributions and expenditures, reasoning that they were regulations of conduct rather than speech. Now, in Citizens United, obviously, the court has disagreed. Your thoughts in the 30 seconds we have left?
Well, I guess all I can say in 30 seconds is I think it's ironic that this school of judicial thought thinks that there is a form of speech which is allowed, first of all, to exercise itself in secret, although they're claiming transparency, and secondly, which not everyone is free to do.
Yeah, and I find it amazing that from George Washington until the 70s, and even in even in Buckley, arguably, that speech, that regulating financial expenditures was considered, quote, regulations of conduct. And now they're saying, putting money into political campaigns is speech. It's bizarre. R.J. Eskow, the OurFuture.org, of course, but this is the ZeroHour.com. Check it out. Good luck, R.J.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Richard's website, his show, is going to be playing on many of our stations this weekend. This is the ZeroHour.com. Very coadjutantly ugly, the good. The Golden State Warriors. According to sports columnist Marcus Thompson, the team was prepared to boycott its Tuesday night game with the LA Clippers if the NBA commissioner Adam Silver did not ban Clippers owner Donald Sterling for his racist remarks. Thompson wrote, the Warriors players wanted to protest previously but decided to give Silver a chance to do the right thing. But if Silver had announced the punishment for Sterling's bigoted comments were an indefinite suspension and a measly fine, the Warriors were ready to make an historic statement. Luckily for Warriors fans, Commissioner Silver did end up banning Donald Sterling for life. But that shouldn't take away from what the team planned to do. No one pays the Warriors to make political statements, and it's impressive that they were willing to go that far to take a stand against racism. The bad. Gun nuts. When Belinda Padilla, the CEO and president of the U.S. division of Armatax, a German gun manufacturer, decided to introduce a safer gun into the marketplace, she thought she was going to be applauded for her commitment to public safety. Instead, she's been harassed by gun nuts and extremists who think Armatax's smart gun, a gun that can only be fired by its owner, is a threat to their freedom. Padilla said, told the New York Times on Sunday that she does not pick up unknown calls anymore, not since someone posted her cell phone number in an online forum for gun enthusiasts. Phone harassment isn't the worst of Padilla's problems, though. Someone also snapped pictures of the address where she has a P.O. box and put these online, too. In a crude cartoonish scrawl, this person drew an arrow to the blurred image of a woman passing through the photo frame. Belinda, the person wrote, is that you? Remember all this because Belinda Padilla tried to make owning a gun safer. That should tell you all you need to know about what gun nuts really care about. And the very, very ugly Glenn Beck. During a discussion about Hillary Clinton's support for same-sex marriage on his radio show yesterday, the conservative pundit took Republican dog whistling about the former Secretary of State to a new low. Take a look.
Hang on just a second. So what I heard you just say is Hillary came out last year? Because I didn't think that had been officially...
The arc of history. The arc of history. That's
I'm telling you, Hillary Clinton will be having sex with a woman on the White House desk if it becomes popular. She'll be just like... She'll be like, look, the arc of history wasn't ready for a president to be a lesbian and have sex on the desk.
Yeah, Hillary's been the target of this kind of attack since John McCain was making jokes about her and Janet Reno being Chelsea Clinton's real parents. What Glenn Beck said wasn't only sexist, it was also gay-shaming in the worst possible way. And very, very ugly. Gay-shaming isn't quite the right word. What is the right word for trashing gay people? Homophobic. Yeah. Yeah, bigoted. There you go. Okay. Francisco in Chicago. Hey, Francisco. Thanks for listening to WCPT. What's on your mind today? Hello?
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Yep. Sure.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I read an article in the New York Times over the weekend that stated Walmart's fortune is spreading over to education. It seems like they're funding a lot of the charter schools. They even funded, it seems, according to the article, the meetings with Ron Emanuel and so forth to see how they were going to go about closing some of the public schools. I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on that. I don't know too much about it, but I definitely have interest in charter schools. I just didn't know that, you know, the charter schools, and I'm not too sure this is nationwide, were receiving any funding from Walmart, which it seems to be impacting.
It's not Walmart. It's either the Walmart Foundation or it's the Walton Family Foundation. And I don't know the details of it, but I believe that they have been supporters of the charter school movement. And whether they're toxic supporters or not, I'm not, and or the Gates Foundation for that matter, I'm not the expert on that topic. But I can tell you that there are a lot of billionaires and a lot of very, very wealthy people who are very much on the bandwagon of let's privatize education in the United States. And it's not a good thing for democracy in America, and it's not a healthy thing. And Francisco, one of our underwriters, proflowers.com, has given us some free flower, you know, send flowers to somebody for Mother's Day or for any time if you'd like, and for me to give away. Would you like a gift certificate? Okay,
yeah,
great.
Absolutely.
Let me put you on hold. Francisco's on line four, Danielle. And Danielle will get your contact information, and we'll get them off to you. Catherine in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Well, I've got some exciting news. The Voice Project got connected to the Solidarity Sing-Along. Do you know about the Voice Project?
I don't.
Okay, well, it's a nonprofit, and their mission is to utilize the power of music to effect positive social change, alleviate suffering, and promote human rights around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
They're a good part of the reason why Pussy Riot did not die in jail. They sent a lawyer every day to check on them.
Wow.
And they were inspired to do this work by, over in Uganda, the widows and rape survivors and former abductees were banding together to support each other, and they were singing songs.
Mm-hmm.
And they developed songs that told the former child soldiers that they were forgiven and that they could come back.
Wow.
And so they were following the violent arrests of the singers at the state capitol here, and the fact that they...
In Madison,
and that the fact that they needed to go to court, and they came here, and they made a video. So you can see it online. It's voiceproject.org/solidarity.
Cool.
Awesome. That's professional great. Video. It would be great if you could have the Voice Project on your TV show and show the video. It would be awesome. And what they also do is through all of these things, they raise money. It's kind of a chain of events. You need to look at their website and see how they talk about an artist will cover a song and then the next person will do something. It's just fantastic.
I'll have to check it out. Catherine, thanks for the heads up. I appreciate it. And
have a good day.
You're welcome. Thank you. Christine in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hey, Christine, what's up?
Hey. Get you off a speakerphone.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask a question, since it's any, you know, anything goes. The poison pill that was put into the pension plan for the post office,
mm-hmm.
causing them to...
Into the Postal Reform Act, actually.
Was correct. Yeah. What was... How did the people who were pushing for that, how were they trying, you know, in public to justify that kind of... You know, the 75 years out, what
yeah.
were they doing? Now, we know it was probably union busting at their level or their attempt to get rid of one of the biggest
yes.
unions. But in the event, I'm asking, you know, for someone to be kind of a devil's advocate in case I ever get into a conversation.
No, I'll tell you what I know about this, and I learned this from Senator Sanders, although I've read a number of articles about it. Bernie was in Congress. He was a member of the House of Representatives when this passed. And there was this, it was an omnibus postal reform bill back in 2006 during the Bush administration. And it was fixing a lot of problems that the post office had and was, you know, opening up some new possibilities for the post office. It did a lot of reasonable things and even a few good things. There were different versions of it, however, in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And so when you have the House pass a bill and the Senate pass a bill that does the same thing, but they have even one word that's different, they have to go to what's called a conference committee. And a conference committee, the Speaker of the House and the leader of the Senate appoint people from both parties, a small number, you know, three, four, five people from each party, from their body. And those 10, 12, 15, 20 people, it depends on the bill, it depends on the time of year, it depends on, you know, what's a whole bunch of things. They get together as what's called conferees, as a conference, and they work out a compromise that has legislation that presumably both bodies, the House and the Senate, can agree on. And their job in a conference is not to substantially change the legislation. And their job, if they make any changes of consequence, is to be sure to inform both the House and the Senate before it comes out of conference and is sent for a vote about what those substantial changes are. And apparently, when this bill was in conference, a Republican, and I'm forgetting the name of the Republican, I believe he's no longer in the House, but we had his name at one point, slipped this thing in just before it was voted on by the conferees, and they didn't realize he had slipped it in, that said that the retirees' health funds 75 years from now have to be prepaid over a 10-year period. And it was written in a way that it was very obscure. It was very hard to actually even know that it was there because it referenced other pieces of legislation and that kind of thing. And so this came out of conference, and other than the guy who slipped it in, pretty much nobody even knew it was there. And then, but they all did know all the other changes, and they publicized those, and the bill then went to the House and Senate, and both the House and Senate passed it, and boom, the next year when it went into effect, the roof fell on the post office. And any effort to fix that has been blocked by Republicans in both the House and Senate ever since. So that's my understanding of how it played out, Christina. And perhaps somebody in the chat room can come up with the name of the person who was responsible for that. Thanks a lot for the call. Maybe not the chat room, whatever. Maybe somebody on Twitter. Maybe somebody can call. But at one point we knew who that was. We had this conversation about 6 months ago. Anyway, we'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the reason, of course, that the Republicans wanted to destroy the post office is that it is the single largest unionized employer in the United States. They're trying to bust the union. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Carl watching Free Speech TV in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Carl, thanks for watching DirecTV. What's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
Tom, you know, I've been wondering about something, right? You know, the Democrats, why can't they take these I have a saying. What's your plan?
Right.
Why can't they get some of those bills that's in the House of Representatives right now that's creating for jobs and show the American people, listen, this bill would create such and such amount of jobs, and these are the people that's blocking it. I mean, be honest with you, Tom, I really don't know why people vote Republican anyway. No. You know, I'm in a union, and I see a lot of my members, like, they vote against their own interests. And I wonder why. I'm like, dude, these guys want to take away your pension. They want to take away your Social Security, all of these things.
Yeah, but they want to make sure you can have a gun.
Yeah, right?
No, I mean, I'm serious. This is how Republicans win elections, is what they have historically called wedge issues. They want to make sure that people can have guns. They want to limit the rights of minorities to vote. They want to, and a whole lot of other things. They want to make sure that there's religion in our schools and our public institutions, their religion. They want to make life harder for gay people. I mean, you know, and they want to make it harder for women to get an abortion or have any kind of power in the workplace. And there are micro constituencies among your union buddies for every single one of those positions. And, you know, somebody is going to grab onto one of those positions and say, aha, this is why I'm a Republican. And that's what they do, and that's how they do it. In fact, here, let me give you just an example of what, I mean, this is, I'm looking at democraticunderground.com right now. And they have this graphic up that's like, you know, one of these worthy of Facebook and will probably show up all over Facebook graphics that they do every day. And they do such a good job with them. And this one points out that yesterday, The House and Ways and Means Committee, which is the most powerful committee in the House of Representatives because they handle money, basically. They appropriate money. They blocked a bill that would have kept foster kids out of prostitution and would have cost $1 million a year over a decade, $12 million altogether. They blocked this bill, $1 million a year, because they said it was too expensive. Then they approved a bill that would spend $31 billion. That's not $1 million. That's $31,000 million. $31 billion a year over 10 years. That's $310 billion. $310,000 million on tax cuts for big corporations without paying for any of them. So $310 billion for corporations, yes. $10 million to keep foster kids out of prostitution, no. That's just yesterday out of the House of Representatives, out of the Republicans in the House of Representatives. Now, the problem is, this is a matter of public record, and progressives all know this. I mean, this is on all the progressive websites, and you know, I just talked about it. Other progressives will be talking about it on Progressive Talk Radio. No conservative is going to talk about it, and the mainstream media won't talk about it because they don't call Republicans out. That's the problem, Carl.
That was the Ronald Reagan thing back in the days. Don't talk bad about, you know.
Yeah, the 11th commandment. Don't speak ill of a fellow Republican. But I mean, Republicans actually, these are positions that they support, so they wouldn't even be calling them out. It's just that the press is so cowed by the Republican Party. They have had so many years of people in the Republican Party screaming, liberal bias, liberal bias, that they're afraid to point out things like what I just shared with you, which have no, I mean, there's no liberal bias. This is just facts. This is what happened yesterday in the House Ways and Means Committee. Carl, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by the efforts to free an American political prisoner, former governor, Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, free-don.org, and goatsfortheoldgoat.com, Ellen Ratner's charity based out of South Sudan. We're going to be having in the next hour some guests of Ellen's on our program. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Tom.
So what's up today?
So the White House weighed in today on the debate over the botched execution in Oklahoma, and we've got an update on what Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon is doing. Jay Carney, White House press secretary, was asked a question about it during the briefing. He said he'd not talked to President Obama about the incident, but that the White House viewed the episode as having fallen short of being humane. We have a fundamental standard in this country that even when the death penalty is justified, it must be carried out humanely, and I think everyone would recognize that this case fell short of that standard. He said that Obama believes there are some crimes that are so heinous that the death penalty is merited. He said this was one of them. Also, Oklahoma Governor Republican Mary Fallon said at a very brief news conference that she'd asked for an independent review of the failed execution of Clayton Lockett by the state's Department of Public Safety. She said she'd asked for a full assessment of Lockett's cause of death, a review of whether officials have followed execution protocols and whether those protocols needed to be improved. There is no deadline for that review.
Wow.
So that the stay for the execution of Charles Warner will go on, which is a 14-day stay. That will go on until the investigation is finished.
Here's what baffles me, Victoria.
Yes.
I am an opponent of the death penalty, and I think it dehumanizes all of us. And you know, I don't want to be in the same company with Saudi Arabia on this kind of thing, but. If you're going to have that said, if you're going to have a death penalty, why not either A, go back to public guillotining, which is instantaneous and painless, or Charles Guillotine came up with a pretty good idea, I think. Or if you're going to use drugs, why don't we do it the way we put down animals? We give them either massive overdoses of barbiturates or narcotics. And my father was on so much morphine that I'm guessing that in his last three or four breaths, the hospice nurse had just given him another large dose of morphine. He may as easily have died from the morphine as from the cancer. I don't know. But he was okay with it. You know, I mean, We know that these drugs kill people, and they do it quite quickly, and they do it rather pleasantly. Give people overdoses of phenobarbital or morphine, and they drift into a pleasant haze and then into unconsciousness, and then they die, and it takes about 3 or 4 minutes. Why don't they do that?
I don't know the answer to that. We seem to be stuck.
It's this whole complicated, we got to give them some weird benzo drug, and then we got to freeze their heart, and you know, it's a... You know, come on, this isn't rocket science. I mean, in Washington State, where death with dignity is legal, the doctor can prescribe for you 6 ounces of phenobarbital, and you just drink it, and, you know, an hour later, you're dead. You got to have two doctors certify that you're within 6 months of dying, and you're in terminal pain and all that kind of stuff. But the fact of the matter is we do this. It's humane. It's, you know, people hang out with their friends while they're dying. Maybe it's that you get a nice buzz from those two drugs, and that's why they don't want to do it.
Maybe.
Which is bizarre. Anyhow, maybe. Back to you for the rest of the news. Forgive all my editorializing.
It is your show.
Well, I appreciate thank you.
Republicans filibustered an effort by Democrats in the Senate to advance a bill to increase the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10 today. A vote was 54 to 42. They needed 60 votes to advance the measure.
Yeah, we had Senator Sanders on about that. Is there an individual Republican whose name is attached to that filibuster?
You mean who voted with the Democrats?
No, I mean who stood up and said, I object, because a filibuster is an objection to cloture.
Right.
So,
in the stories I've read, I've not seen one so far. The stories are still coming out.
Because so often we never hear who was the person who objected, or Mitch McConnell automatically
does it. Mitch McConnell did object. Mike Enzi objected. But I don't know who was the original objector. I don't know.
Because we should start putting names on these filibusters, you know.
Yeah, I don't know who was the original.
Well, who was
objector?
He used to be a Dixiecrat. Strom Thurmond. He was so proud of filibustering civil rights bills, you know.
Yeah, he got behind it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, anyway, back to you.
Six Ohio same-sex couples today filed a federal lawsuit challenging the state's ban on same-sex marriage, joining advocates in several states seeking to make gay nuptials legal through the courts. Now, this follows a federal judge's ruling earlier this month that the state must recognize gay marriages performed in other jurisdictions.
So we're moving step by step.
Moving step by step in that state, yes. Also, leaders of the Senate Intelligence Committee have reached a compromise on legislation to help protect the country's cyber networks and going to formally introduce a bill shortly, they said today. It's a bill from Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein, Ranking Member Saxby Chambliss. It would allow companies to share more information with each other about cyber threats, which they don't do because everybody's terrified of being sued.
Or antitrust violations?
Yes, all of the above.
Yeah. Isn't it,
Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission told them earlier this month that they would not consider discussions about anti-hacking efforts a violation of antitrust laws.
Yeah. And beyond that, the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, just came out and said, if you're using Microsoft Internet Explorer, stop.
Oh, stay away.
Yeah. Regardless of how recent it is, regardless of how updated it is, that program is not secure, officially, according to the Department of Homeland Security, which is mind-boggling.
Right. They have not fixed that bug.
Yeah. It's mind-boggling. Anyway, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. I thought we were hitting the clock here. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you very much.
And our newscast also brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, and I noticed a new article in The Nation magazine, thenation.com, titled Cold War Against Russia Without Debate by Katrina Vandenhoevel and Stephen F. Cohen. And I wanted to get Professor Cohen back on the program. Professor Emeritus at New York University and Princeton University, contributing editor to The Nation, author of the book Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War, back on the program to discuss this. Professor Cohen, Steve, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. We talked about this to some extent last week, that we have essentially declared a cold war. You want to recap that and then get into where we're at now?
Well, relations with Russia now over Ukraine look like, smell like, sound like, act like Cold War. So it is Cold War. But we have additional confirmation. This you and I did talk about. A week ago Sunday, on the front page of the New York Times, was a report by Peter Baker. The source was Obama aides, which said that President Obama had given up on Putin as a negotiating partner, now sought to isolate Russia to make it a pariah state, and was adopting the strategy of containment. Containment was, of course, the 45-year Western policy toward the Soviet Union. So it is Cold War. I have no doubt about that. For 20 years, I've been writing, warning that Cold War was unfolding in Washington, and eventually Moscow would push back. The danger today is, just look at the headlines today, what's coming from Ukraine, is this is a Cold War that could trip into hot war with Russia. I would go so far as to say that the possibility is not quite as grave as it was during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, but we're getting there because things get worse every day. So I think that's where we are today. And just in a word, the thesis of this editorial that I wrote with my wife, Katrina Vandenhoevel, who's the editor and publisher of The Nation, is that this is astonishing because it's such a turning point, fateful turning point in history. There is, unlike in European countries, no American debate in the mainstream. Now, I would need, if you want to give me a footnote, to say where that debate is taking in America, but it's not where it needs to be in the mainstream media, because not one of the 535 members of Congress has said a word about all this. Do they know? Are they afraid? Do they agree with the White House? There's no precedent. We debated Vietnam. We debated Iraq a couple times. We debated Iran. We debated Libya. We've debated Syria. We debate wars in this country, and foolishly we may go into those wars, but at least the democracy speaks. Democracy is mute in America today, at least in the mainstream. And that's the argument of the editorial. It's a call for these people to speak out.
Yeah. I believe maybe two or three weeks ago, Congressman Alan Grayson said something to the effect of, the EU and the United States have helped botch this too, and we need to consider the Russian point of view on this, and it's not as simple as it's being portrayed in the media. And earlier today we had Senator Sanders on, and somebody called in and said, what do you think about what's going on in the Ukraine? And he said, we do not need another war. This has the potential to be a war. We need to step back. We need to, I'm paraphrasing from memory, my apologies, but he spoke fairly forcefully about let's not make any stupid mistakes here. But the larger context that you and I have talked about so many times about how this came about, the history of this, I frankly don't think most members of Congress know.
I've been around a long time. I don't know what Congress collectively or individually knows about anything. But what you just reported interests me. That Senator Sanders spoke out is good. I want to add, we have been lobbying him, and he had this editorial in his office before it went up at thenation.com and appears in the magazine before. I don't know who Grayson is. I don't know about him. That's good. When I wrote the sentence, 535 members of Congress have remained silent, I wanted to provoke one or more of them to say, wait a minute, I said something, to which my answer is, well, you need to say it more loudly. Yeah. So that's good news. There was also, to give credit where credit's due, on the right wing, there's a Republican congressman from California, Dana, and I always
mangle
him. Yeah, he said, I think early on, back in November or December when this crisis was unfolding in Ukraine, that we're pushing Russia too hard. And by the way, Senator Rand Paul from my own home state of Kentucky said the same thing. They fell silent. So, I mean...
Well, and let me just FYI add to this, after Congressman Grayson made his statement, and he's been a regular guest on our program, he's one of the most progressive and outspoken. He's the congressman with guts guy. He's the guy who got up on the floor and said, here's the Republicans' plan for health insurance. Don't get sick. If you do get, number one. Number two, if you do get sick, die quick. You know, he's known for, he's an outspoken guy, and he's been on our show many times. After he said that, we invited him on the program, both the TV program on RT and also on Free Speech TV and on this radio program. And he has not been available yet to us since then. So I think that your analysis that even when these guys speak out, suddenly they back off is probably...
But let's think about this. You and I, more you than really myself, represent, generally speaking, the progressive wing of the American political spectrum.
Sure.
I'm a little more conservative about various things. Argue with my wife about them all the time. But here's what's interesting and alarming, that one would expect progressive liberals to speak out on this issue. And they are more silent than the conservative wing. On the conservative wing, you have Pat Buchanan saying things very similar to what I'm saying. You have a bunch of no longer so young devotees of Reagan, because they believe Reagan ended the Cold War, furious that Washington's restarting the Cold War and destroying Reagan's legacy. They're speaking out. Now, let's be fair for a minute. Let's look at what does exist in left or progressive media. There's the Tom Hartman Show in its various forms. There's Democracy Now.
Yeah. Amy Goodman has spoken out on this, and she's had you on her show.
By the way, there's John Batchelor, where I appear almost every Tuesday night on national ABC. But mm-hmm. John Batchelor is an old friend and a kind of quirky guy, though he's a conservative Republican. He just thinks about things. And then, of course, I have to say that The Nation, which is probably closer to the mainstream because of its venerable age, nearly 150 years old, has been taking this position. But the reality is we don't impact the policymakers.
Right.
In fact, I think sometimes they have an allergy to us. And so the question is an alternative media such as you and The Nation and Democracy Now! Enough in matters of war and peace? And if it's not, how do we thrust ourselves into what should be a debate? And the only way I know of doing it is to get those members of Congress who aren't loyal to the point of being zombies or who aren't brain dead to international issues to begin to think and speak. But if you look at MSNBC on this issue, they're every bit as bad as Fox.
Well, they're largely silent, other than a little bit of jingoism here and there. I you know, this is also an election year, and I have to assume that on both sides of the aisle, everybody is scared to death that they're going to be accused of being pro-Putin or pro-Russia or whatever, you know, by their opponents.
I guess that's right. And we went through this during the last Cold War.
Yep.
That if you said, hold on a minute, aren't we building too many nuclear weapons? We're going to blow ourselves up. People said you were a red or you were a commie or you were pro-Kremlin. But my view is that when we elect people to represent us, we don't want scaredy cats. And we don't want people who think only about re-election. Moreover, it's not clear this is a losing issue. Somebody once said that kerosene oil.
Professor Stephen, we're hitting a break here. Hold that thought. I want to hear what somebody once said in just a moment. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We're talking with Professor Stephen Cohen. He's writing in The Nation, the new piece, Cold War Against Russia Without Debate, thenation.com. Stephen Cohen, welcome back. You were going to say, I'm sorry for the, we have hard breaks on the show because we are both for-profit and not-for-profit, and, you know, it just has to, so the machine determines the time. I don't, unlike some other shows, so.
No apology needed.
Anyhow, back to you.
When we think about our elected representatives who either don't think about these things and are silent, or who think about them but are silent anyway, lack the courage of their convictions, I recall some great leader once said that all dissent begins as heresy and as a political minority. But if it's rightful dissent, it becomes the majority and eventually is accepted. We've seen that in American history repeatedly. I grew up in the South. I saw it about civil rights. I'm old enough to remember how dissent to the Vietnamese War began, a tiny minority. Mm. And so it goes, and so it goes. It's just astonishing to me, Tom, that there is less debate about this turn toward we're in a new Cold War, this danger of hot war with Russia. The only explanation that I can come up with, leaving aside the fear factor and re-election and loyalty and wanting to defend Obama and all that, is that the majority of our representatives actually believe that Russia, Putin, are solely responsible for this crisis, that we did nothing to provoke it or abet it. But that's not true. And the reason they think this is that we aren't exploring these issues in the mainstream media. Briefly, I was on mainstream television, and I said to them what I'm saying to you, maybe a little more decorously, because I wanted to be invited back, and there was a torrent from center and left media calling me Putin's apologist in America. Long articles,
sure.
4, 6. Not because they want to silence me, because I'm nobody. They want to make sure that nobody who's somebody might say, hey, you know, Cohen's been studying this for 45 years, maybe we ought to think about it. And that's where we are.
Yeah.
And we're talking about the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, all the cable TV stations, and, of course, commercial broadcast TV and radio, except for these exceptions that I mentioned, including your broadcast.
Okay. So, and you're paraphrasing, in a way, Gandhi, you know, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, then you win. Or the, what was it, Dante? There's a special place in hell for people who don't speak out during times of crisis.
Actually, to be fair, I was quoting Mikhail Gorbachev.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Because he came to power as a heretic. He was a heretic in the Kremlin. He wanted to dismantle Soviet orthodoxy.
Yeah.
And he was called a heretic by people.
Still is.
Still, well, but at that time, it wasn't clear how that was going to turn out.
Yeah.
This was 85, 86. And we were living in Russia, and we heard this. And he was a minority in his own Communist Party. And then he wasn't, and now he is again, because he's long since left the party. But the point is that great, I mean, this is really a lesson of history. Great virtuous change, the idea of it, is always denounced in the beginning as heresy. And they try to silence the heretics. Or heretics silence themselves. And a minority, but then it gains force and it grows and circumstances that make it seem like.
Yep, we'll be right back. Here's that break again. Professor Stephen Cohen with us. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past. Professor Stephen Cohen with us, New York, professor emeritus at NYU and Princeton, and co-author with Katrina Vandenhoevel of a new piece, Cold War Against Russia, Without Debate, in thenation.com. Professor Cohen, it's something I'm curious about. I believe it was the president who said this a couple days ago, or maybe it was Kerry, or maybe it was attributed just to the White House. But there was a charge made that the U.S. had evidence, solid evidence, that a number of the people who were helping to occupy these Russian, Ukrainian cities on the east part of Ukraine, the people who are being described as pro-Russians were actually definitely not just Russians, but Russian officers, Russian intelligence agents. Here's their face, here's their name, that kind of thing. And this actually is being orchestrated by the Russian government. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are this, and this links directly to my argument we're not having a debate. There are two fundamental axioms of the American media narrative. Russia began all this. It's just not true. We discussed this last time I was on.
Sure.
We've been over it. The other is that Russia is now violating the agreement that was made in Geneva to de-escalate the crisis. And the evidence is the spreading unrest in eastern Ukraine, which borders Russia, and which is populated mostly by either people who are ethnically Russian, this is not always the same thing, or are native Russian speakers, and therefore they have an affinity for Russia. And the argument is that Russia is, Putin is inspiring, agitating, instigating this unrest, which is taking the form of the seizures of buildings, the blockading of streets, and that he's also unwilling to tamp it down or call it off. Now, if we were having a debate, it would go something like this. People such as myself would say, yes, there are undoubtedly Russian agents operating in these East European towns. I actually personally don't know what they're doing or how many they are, but I know that the evidence has been produced by the Obama administration and was printed in the New York Times was false, and the Times has apologized. I refer to those photographs they published.
Oh, really?
They now with alleged recognizable, identifiable right. Russian agents there. In other words, you're getting a tremendous amount of misinformation generated out of Kiev and out of Washington. Huh. So we would have a debate about this, and we would sort this out. But here's the real point. Anyone, including President Obama and Kerry, who believe that the conflicts in Ukraine are not indigenous and they are not the product of 300 years of history and are the basic problem, and who believe if Putin would go on Kremlin TV tomorrow and say to the eastern Ukrainians stop, that they would stop, Obama and Kerry should resign tomorrow because they are ignorant of the reality of the situation. Whether they really believe that, I don't know. This whole crisis, what underpins it, are the profound divisions in Ukraine, geographic, religious, ideological, ethnic, political, economic. That's what's created a kind of looming civil war. Putin could make it better or make it worse. But I ask you a question. If you wanted to de-escalate, why would you tell our regime in Kiev to send troops to the east, 15 armored divisions, helicopters, aircrafts? Okay, they haven't fired, but they're a couple kilometers from these towns. That's a provocation. That's an escalation. So if anybody is escalating manifestly, where we can look at our televisions and see the footage and see the evidence, it's the American-backed government in Kiev. So when Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, comes here Friday, I believe, to the United States and has a secret talk with Obama, I will bet you anything she raises this question. How can you ask the Russians to try to tamp down the unrest of eastern Ukraine if our government in Kiev is sending tanks there?
Well, isn't NATO also amping up their forces in Poland and Lithuania and Latvia?
NATO is mobilizing troops toward, let's be clear about this, the countries in Eastern Europe, virtually all of them, including the Baltic countries on Russia's borders, that NATO took in during this kind of Pac-Man-like NATO expansion during the last 20 years, did not, by agreement with the Russians, NATO did not station there permanent advanced military forces. Now they are doing that. They built an infrastructure, airstrips, barracks, and the rest. But what NATO is now doing, and why say NATO? It's Washington. Washington controls NATO because it pays NATO's bills. Washington has decided to move NATO troops, including 150 American paratroopers, to, I think, 5 or 6 countries, which is idiocy. If an American dies at the hands of a sniper or a Russian or a provocateur or he gets drunk and falls down in front of a car, people are going to be clamoring for war against Russia. You shouldn't put Americans in harm's way in this situation. Put Italians or others who are not such a lightning rod for this confrontation. But you are right. We are moving NATO troops, not we, but Washington, to the perimeters of Russia. And here's the danger. If the Ukrainian situation becomes more unruly, more fractious, it's not too violent at the moment, but more violent, Russian troops would probably cross into Ukraine on the east. Those NATO troops, which are being mobilized, would cross into western Ukraine, cross the Polish border. And I've said so often, people want me to shut up, but that would be the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Or the Vietnam War.
All to eyeball.
I mean, you know, you got North and South Vietnam. I mean, that's the echo that immediately occurs to me. Maybe
it's a question. I mean, somebody ought to, if we have a debate in America, here's what one thing we would debate. It's not for us to decide, but it's in the air. Would right. two Ukraines be the solution? What yeah. would be better? A Ukrainian civil war, which would be horrible and probably would trigger a hot war with Russia, east-west, or the partition of Ukraine, if you could figure out where to draw the lines. Two Ukraines, two Ukrainian states, one affiliated with Europe, one affiliated with Russia.
Right. Professor Cohen, thank you so much for dropping by. We've got a couple of guests from South Sudan, another conflict zone, who are going to be in our studio right after this break. So I have to wrap it up here. But I am so grateful to you for giving us a half hour and coming on the program today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Stephen Cohen, his new piece, Cold War Against Russia Without Debate, TheNation.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That's TheNation.com. And it's by Professor Cohen and Katrina VandenHeuvel. Cold War Against Russia Without Debate. Check it. We'll be back. Minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. And tomorrow I'll be in Seattle, tomorrow night, Town Hall Seattle, and Friday night, Portland. And then Saturday night I'm doing a TED Talk in Portland, although that's already sold out. But Friday night in Portland, I'll be at the Unitarian Church. And tomorrow night in Seattle, I will be at Seattle Town Hall. So it should be a lot of fun. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. Going back to one of your callers talking about the Keystone XL pipeline.
Yeah, this guy was called in the last hour, and he said, who's going to provide security for the Keystone XL pipeline?
Yeah.
Is it going to be us, or is it going to be TransCanada?
Yeah. Yeah, so it brings up, there's not a single rational reason for the Keystone pipeline. Some of us call the pipeline to hell. One of the main reasons is just the basic meme, decentralize or die, or actually I've got a new meme. Centralization magnifies mistakes by many magnitudes.
Yeah, it's true, too.
And so if you look at examples we already have, we've already got a pipeline in Alaska. So just one drunk guy with just one bullet took out the Alaska pipeline for several days. And spilled about 1 million liters of oil.
Really?
So all
was, when was that?
Yeah. October 5th, 2001.
Wow.
Yeah, so just look up drunk bullet Alaska pipeline, and you'll find it. It's very easy.
So,
and that was only discovered by a helicopter flying overhead that saw the oil.
Wow.
But right now in the South, so the counterexample of how decentralization brings security, centralization is the least secure thing you can do. Right now in the South, we've had all these tornadoes hitting thousands of people without power,
right.
except for one group of people. Those are solar panels. Solar heating and solar electric still have power.
Right, right. It's
so it's like if you want security, if you want freedom, you do not want pipelines. You want, and because what's going to happen, there's one thing for sure. Oil prices are going to go up.
Yeah.
Solar prices are going to go down. And once you have the solar panels, you don't pay bills anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Although the Koch brothers want you to pay taxes if you have solar panels.
Yep.
They're quite aggressive about that.
As Bernie said, 60% of the people don't vote. We need to get that other 60%. Even if we got 3% of those people to vote, we turn the elections around.
Yeah.
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 So we must have decentralized power, decentralized water, decentralized vote counting, all these things because, centralization magnifies mistakes by many magnitudes.
Yes. Yep. Jeff, thank you so much for calling. You're spot on. We have in the studio, and I would like to introduce, and please forgive my my no doubt mispronunciations, but two gentlemen from South Sudan, the Honorable Tongden Anai, the State Minister of Health, that would be you, sir, and Dr. Mayan Machu Achek. It's close enough. Okay, and Ellen was in here telling us earlier that the situation in South Sudan is not going so well right now. Would one of you care to begin by addressing what's going on right now? Give us a little news update.
Okay, thank you so much. You have heard already my name.
You need to push the mic, pull the microphone right to your mouth, and speak directly into it. There you go.
Thank you so much for inviting us here.
There you go.
Okay, good. My name is Honorable Tongden. I'm the State Minister of Health in South Sudan. And it is a pleasure to be here today. Just what I want to give you the brief highlight is that, in fact, the situation in Southern Sudan is not very good in three states of South Sudan. That is in Upper Nile, Unity, and Jonglei State, that where there is a conflict at the moment. Because we have 10 states in Southern Sudan, 7 states of Southern Sudan are okay, but the conflict is actually going on in the other three states.
Yeah.
So what is going on at the moment is to work around the clock to see that the conflict is brought down. And to do that, there is a peace process that is going on at the moment in Addis. They were in the break in the middle, but they have gone back on Monday, and the peace process is going on now. What I will not be able to tell you is what has been agreed, and there is nothing that has been agreed yet, but what they discussed for the last 2 days is what I don't know, because I've been here and they've just started, and the process is actually, I can say, it's moving on. Okay.
Okay.
So, unless you have some more questions.
Let me ask Dr. Achek, is that Achek?
Yes, I'm Mayan Achek. I'm a surgeon and an assistant professor of surgery at the medical school in Juba.
Uh-huh. I've been to Juba. I've been with all the way up to Gok Machar with Ellen.
It's a pleasure to know that.
Thank you. Good work. Goats for the Old Goat.com, which is Ellen's charity, I know is doing a lot of work in South Sudan. But what do you want people to know about what's going on there and where they can go and what they
really
can do?
As a doctor and as a professional, what I would like the people of the U.S. to know is that we are struggling. Our people are struggling. The healthcare situation is stark, not because of the war, even before the war, because we are forming. The war, of course, has made it worse for the three states the minister just mentioned a few seconds ago, but in general, it's tough. It's tough in terms of the resources, human resources and materials. The hospitals are buildings that have been there for the last 60 years or so. They are derelict, and they are really not holding well. We would like people to help us to rehabilitate this while we're working building new hospitals. The government is working hard to build new hospitals in all the main towns and cities of all the states. And also, we have a problem of the human resource, the manpower, specialist manpower, doctors and nurses, and we don't have training institutions that are functioning well. The only medical school that's working at Juba, which is College of Medicine, University of Juba, has a problem of faculty, the teaching faculty. Only 14 senior lecturers, and that's all including the dean. And that is tough. That is not a satisfactory number to train future doctors, but we don't have anyone else, so we're working hard. And that's why we are asking friends, the whole world, to help us. Now we have got two nursing colleges. One is working in Juba and is producing a very small number and is functioning. The other one is the one we're trying hard to open in northern Baragazar in Awil. That is going to produce a bigger number, about 120. We are actually aspiring to produce more from there. So these are two factories that we really like to produce the healthcare cadre from South Sudan to alleviate the suffering of the people.
Yeah. Is there, Doctor, any, are there good NGOs that are working in South Sudan that you would recommend people to? And I'm assuming that the U.S. government has been providing some assistance to your government. I guess this is more a question for the minister. We'll get to that in just a second. But first, are there any NGOs that...
Most NGOs that are working, they're doing a great job. Some of them are American. Some of them are from continental Europe. To mention one or two, like Safe Children Fund, MSF, and CRIC. That all these institutions are doing a good job. And well, USAID as well is helping through some of these organizations. And to mention as well, UNFPA.
Right.
It's also one of those organizations working out. Yes,
okay,
yes.
Right.
We've got a number of them. And especially Northern Barghazal is the best example of these organizations doing a good job. The minister here, credit to him, has internalized them. They are part of the establishment. So they work hand in hand with the counties. We call them counties. I mean, they're administrative areas. And therefore, they are actually helping actively in the administration and the delivery of the healthcare
that's
services.
Great.
So it's just a wonderful thing.
Minister, we have maybe a minute and a half left. I'm curious, is the American government helping out, and what other governments are?
Okay, thank you so much. Actually, what I want to tell you that American government has been very helpful for South Sudan. I could say that during the war, the first war, and during the CPA, without the American government, there would have been no peace that has come to South Sudan. So that's something that I want to make it clear. The other thing that I want to say here is that, as you mentioned, you asked about the NGOs that are working in South Sudan. There are a good number of NGOs that are working in South Sudan, and most of them actually are working with us in health, and we have very good relation with them, both NGOs and the UN. We are working in health. So we work very closely and work together. But I would also like to add a point of what Dr. Mayen has mentioned about Southern Sudan is an area that has a very high mortality rate in the world. There are very, very big mortality rate, and especially with the women and children dying at birth. This is an area that we are working very hard in health to see that this thing has been reduced.
Yeah.
By setting up the training, and we want to make sure that the training for the mid-cadres level is set up so that we make sure that these nurses, the midwife, are trained and work down within their community.
That's great.
It's just an example here.
We have to wrap it up. But thank you so much, both of you, for being here. To South Sudan, the newest country in the world, an area the size of Texas. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more in just a second. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jerry in Kent, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Jerry, what's up? You have some thoughts on Mr. Gorbachev in Russia?
Yeah, I do. The discussion you had with Dr. Cohen, and you can have the good doctor on every week as far as I'm concerned. But back in 1969, I was a pilot for the Navy, and I attended an intelligence briefing.
Mm-hmm.
And the intelligence officer said at that time, he says, here's a bit of intelligence that every intelligence agency in the world knows to be true, is that the Russian economy is going to collapse because of its military spending. I don't think you can give a heck of a lot of credit for Ronald Reagan ending the Cold War.
Yeah. No, yes, this was something that Osama bin Laden took credit for, that he bled in Afghanistan, bled the Soviet Union dry. And then he came out and he said he was going to do the same thing to us. And surprise, here we are. $6 trillion in debt later.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll see you tomorrow night, Tom.
Okay, great. Jerry, I look forward to it. Thanks a lot. Ken in Geneva, Illinois. Hey, Ken, what's up? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Thank you. I like your program.
Thank you.
I believe that the Second Amendment doesn't give a person the right to have a gun. There's nothing in the Second Amendment that mentions guns. And the only reference to a gun or guns is the word arms. And according to dictionaries written at the time, here I have to go back to those dictionaries. Most of the dictionaries have one definition for arms is a weapon. So
that would have included knives?
Yeah. They have all sorts of things, bows, arrows, stones, clubs, muskets.
Right.
And arms, let's see, there's only one definition is not to mention guns. In fact, this is comes from the Bailey's English Dictionary of 1755, and they say that they do not mention guns. In fact, they say that they call them instruments. They don't accept a firearm, which is what they called guns at the time, and it doesn't mention firearms. And
You don't think the word arms was short for firearms?
No. Why wouldn't they say firearms or guns if that's what they meant?
Yeah.
When you look up arms, there's many definitions for arms. One of them that I think could be used would be the one of the dictionaries, or three of the dictionaries, say the ensign of a moral of a family consisting of figures, colors borne in shields, banners, as a mark of distinction.
So the flag carried in a battle was considered an arm?
Yes. You know, like the coat of arms.
Right.
It was.
Oh, yeah.
We had all these different countries who have their own flags, and it was something that was.
So we're misreading the Second Amendment? The right to bear, the right to carry a flag shall not be abridged?
Right.
I mean, seriously?
Yeah, because it says the distinction of descending from father to son.
Remarkable. Ken, thank you for the call. Thank you very much. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour. And Carol in St. Paul, Minnesota, listening on AM 950. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Oh, hey, Tom. You know, I want to posit something to you, and I say this because I was working in the late 70s, early 80s. I think this whole privatization goes beyond unions or government. That was after they had started dismantling the rules and regulations that were put in the 30s to prevent overgrowth of anything.
Right.
And
yeah, the additions and amplifications to the Sherman Antitrust Act, basically.
Right. And what happened at that time, I was in the financial industry, and I worked for at that time a rather large bank by those days' standards, not large at all compared to these days. And instead of innovation and creation of new products, which was very difficult to get done because of our size, they started buying up other banks. That was how they made their money, was by buying other banks.
Yeah.
And it's occurred to me that this whole privatization thing has to do with corporations that are too big to be innovative or entrepreneurial or creative in any way, shape, or form, and the only way to make more money is to get bigger. They started buying each other. Then they looked around because there was no other to buy, and they looked to the government and they saw all of the services that the government provided. And I think if you'll recall, it wasn't until Ronald Reagan was elected that we started hearing government was bad.
Right.
And so we were conned into thinking government was bad and somehow private industry was going to do it better. And I say all of this because of the Staples thing with the post office, and the guy who actually sponsored that bill was a funder of Mitt Romney. The guy who funded, who presented the postal bill to the post office. So you look at charter schools, you look at the post office, you look at Staples, you look at how much the government has outsourced its technology.
Its military.
Their military. I mean, I truly think it is because our corporations are not creative in any way, shape, or form anymore.
Yeah, they're merely acquisitive. This is how the game of Monopoly is played, and this is what Ronald Reagan unleashed in the United States in 1982 when he pretty much formally stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. And I think you make an excellent point, Carol. I think you're onto something. Thank you very much for the call and for sharing that. That's brilliant. Vicky in Chester, New Jersey. Hey, Vicky, thanks for listening to WBAI. What's up?
Well, it's Vic, not Vicky.
Oh, Vic, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I had a couple of issues, but maybe one that is cogent with what you've been talking about earlier today about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. And I don't know why commentaries aren't linking this specific issue with other issues like the XL pipeline, GMOs, fracking, because once they've been able to fast track the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement through legislation, all these other issues will become moot. They'll be trumped.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be no more discussion. And also the politicians can sit back and say, it's not our fault.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess I'm wondering why there isn't more linkage. We discuss it separately.
More linkage between the Trans-Pacific Partnership and GMOs.
And anything you want to talk
about. Well, the TPP, I mean, you know, one of the things that the TPP is all about is they call it harmonizing, and they have with every single one of these trade agreements. And what it means is that all the countries that sign onto this thing have to go to the lowest common denominator among them in terms of regulation of industry.
Exactly. Exactly. And they will be then deciding what we have on our plate.
So South Vietnam standards will become our standards.
So anyway, the point is that there hasn't been much demand for transparency in this agreement. There are people who know what's going on, and some information is being leaked. But basically, the American public has just decided to just let it roll. I mean, no one is getting upset about it. But once if it were to be fast tracked, people then would really be. What then do you say?
I predict that there's at least a 70% chance that the lame duck Congress, after the November elections, and probably after Christmas and before the New Year recess, will pass fast track authority, and that the president coming right back into the new year will present a TPP. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong, but we have to be so vigilant about that. Vic, thanks for the call. Well said. Chris in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on 1230 AM. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Nice to speak with you. I was looking at a couple of websites and looking at statistics on the unemployment extension, and they're showing that it's nearly 4 million people are on long-term unemployment currently. So if you imagine that each one of those 4 million has a wife and two kids, or a husband and two kids, being the wife who's unemployed, that's 16 million people directly affected in their households. So that's like 5% of the United States population.
Right. And we've already cut 2 million off since Christmas.
Right. I don't understand. And now that it's passed the Senate, it's going to reach a critical mass or something here. Something's got to happen. Something's got to give.
All John Boehner has to do is allow the House of Representatives to vote on it, and it will pass the House. It will pass. All he has to do is allow a vote, because there will be more than 19 Republicans who join the Democrats to vote for this extension. I mean, there were Republicans who joined the Democrats in the Senate to pass this. It's just, you're absolutely right, Chris. It is a crime against the American people that John Boehner is doing right now. And people should be calling his office and telling him, free the unemployment funds for the unemployed. Now, people are dying, literally. People are divorcing. People are becoming homeless. Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, morality and banking. Really, we'll tell you how one bank is deciding whose money is acceptable and who isn't. And it's May Day, and a victory for the working class. One state has decided to raise the minimum wage without waiting for Congress. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. You know, if they're going to act a tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.